Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're talking about swearing oaths on the Bible, occasioned by a story we dealt with earlier this week, a North Carolina woman who's a Muslim who was a little put off when she could not swear her oath in court on a Quran. She donated Qurans to the courtroom, or at least attempted to do so. They were politely refused, and now she has a case with the ACLU trying to see whether or not the law that provides for, in North Carolina, provides for people to swear upon a Bible but not other holy books is constitutional. I want to hear from you on this story. Should this woman be allowed to take her oath in court on her holy book, the Quran? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Montgomery, when we were talking about this earlier this week, I raised a question with the listeners, and that has to do with oath-taking on the Bible, period. Jesus is quite clear when he says, when you have something to say, let your yes be yes, your no be no. Anything more comes from the evil one. And he explicitly warns against taking oaths on things like the temple or the altar or the gift on the altar or even your own head. How should Christians regard oath-taking, especially when it is, as I said before, hand-on-the-Bible variety oath-taking?
Well, if it's a reinforcement of the belief that one holds, it's a reinforcement of biblical teaching, in the sense of reinforcing one's affirmation of the gospel, one's belief in Jesus Christ, etc., then there's hardly anything the matter with it. It seems to me that the condemnations of oath-taking that you find in Jesus' teaching are condemnations of pagan oath-taking. And that's certainly been the position of the Christian church on this, and the position of Christian governments, that there isn't anything the matter with doing this. But as we said earlier, the problem is that this doesn't carry the guarantees and has never carried the guarantees that some people at least have thought that that it does. And that's why it seems to me that this is probably not the best point for distinguishing between a Christian nation and a non-Christian nation.
Dr. Montgomery, here in the United States, we're already, believe it or not, already swinging into a presidential race with 2 years to go before the election and a full year before our first primary. One of the contenders is Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who is a Mormon. That's another place where you're likely to see people with their hands on the Bible, is when presidents are being sworn into office. What if Mitt Romney wants to swear on the Book of Mormon? Should Christians get upset about it?
Well, I don't think they should. I doubt very much that he would insist on this because, of course, among the Mormons, the scripture is regarded as a secondary authority. There was an article in the London Times, an editorial in the London Times, on whether a Mormon could get elected president in the United States. And the point of the article was, yes, as long as he downplays the fact that he is Mormon. And I'm sure that if Romney entered into that that role, he would not make any great emphasis on the fact that he was Mormon and he would swear on the scriptures. But if he insisted on swearing on the Book of Mormon, it doesn't seem to me that there would be any way to stop that. Again, owing to the fact that the Founding Fathers did not constitutionally make the United States a Christian country in establishing a state church. They did not do this. Our evangelical friends are not able to get around this by saying, that has only to do with the federal government, it doesn't have to do with the state governments, etc. The fact of the matter is that the state governments, likewise, the state constitutions, do not specify that Jesus Christ is Lord or that the Christian church is an established church.
By the way, kudos to Ken Meyer, Bob Meyer's brother, a mutual acquaintance, Dr. Montgomery. I know you don't know Dr. Bob Meyer, for the genesis of the idea there on the whole Mitt Romney issue. How would you respond to an evangelical listening who would say, look, if someone won't put their hand on the Holy Bible, to make their oath of truth in a court, you can't trust what they say. How would you respond, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, if we understand original sin, the fact of the matter is that even if the person is a Christian believer and he swears on Scripture, we cannot be sure that he is telling the truth. We simply can't. The evangelicals go on the assumption that Christians are necessarily empirically more ethical and moral than non-Christians. And that's why there is so much emphasis on sanctification within the evangelical community. This arises out of the Methodist revivals and the rest of it. Now, we are not saying that when a person becomes a Christian, his life isn't changed. Of course it's changed. But that doesn't mean that he becomes a Martian or something of that. He is still a human being. All things have become new, but he is still a sinner. Wesley was dead wrong when he talked about Christian perfection, that one can arrive at this point. And under those circumstances, you can't distinguish the pagans as being the liars and the Christians being the truth tellers necessarily, and the oath is not going to make that distinction either. That's why in the courts of law, in the common law tradition, we have moved away from allowing the oath to determine truth. Just as we've gone away from the idea that you can joust and there can be trial by combat, and whoever happens to win is telling the truth. The only way to determine whether people are telling the truth is to sift the evidence. And if I may make an apologetics point along that line, the only way to tell whether a religion is true is not by the sincerity and the alleged goodness of the person maintaining it. The only way is to check out the case for that religion. And that's why Christianity stands as the true faith, because of the provable resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Steve is up first. He calls from his car. Hi, Steve. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Very well.
Great. You know, your conversation caused me to think that if a non-Christian is willing to put their hand on the Bible and to swear an oath, even though they don't believe that, then how can you trust the integrity of what they're going to say in court or what they're swearing an oath to if they're willing to compromise themselves on swearing on a Bible they don't believe in?
All right, Steve, thank you very much. That's a different twist on the question I asked before, Dr. Montgomery. Your response?
Yeah, it's a really good point, it seems to me. Here we go to the Godfather films and so forth. You know, all of the mafiosi are swearing on Holy Writ, after they've wiped out any number of oppositions. People in the opposition. It seems to me that this cuts both ways. By the way, I can't resist throwing in something which is not directly related to this. I hope that when listeners are dealing with Islam in general, that they will all check out the books of Robert Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R, Robert Spencer. That is a pseudonym. That is not his real name, obviously. He has done three books that are really important. One is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam. One is The Truth About Muhammad, Founder of the World's Most Intolerant Religion. And the third one is The Myth of Islamic Tolerance, How Islam Treats Non-Muslims. These are books that we really ought to assimilate because they provide us with a great deal of important data on the nature of Islam. Now, Islam should be tolerated in an open society, but the practices of Islam through the centuries have been so negative that we should be aware of this and realize that this is in many ways a dangerous religion, even though it's a religion that certainly should not be prohibited by law.
Up next, here's Kathy from St. Charles. Kathy, thank you for being patient. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I guess my concern about bringing the Quran or any other scripture into a courtroom, that if a courtroom is based generally on the principles that come from the Bible and those laws, my concern about the Quran bringing it in is the way they interpret law. how does a Muslim look at this? Do they look at it differently than a Westerner? Do they, instead of seeing it just as something, just taking an oath, and obviously she wasn't okay with just taking the oath without the Bible. Does she, I guess, is it a way for them to kind of say what should really be in this courtroom is the Sharia law? My concern is the way Muslims interpret law.
Kathy, thank you very much. Dr. Montgomery, how would you assuage her concerns?
Interesting as well as a point. Of course, technically, the Muslim holds that the religion and the law of the Quran are totally the same thing, and they must prevail over any competing legal system. There's no doubt about that. That is the official technical position, and in Muslim countries, that's exactly what the Muslim believers try to bring about. Now, in the United States, of course, this is impossible, and there is no way in the world that any American court would permit a Sharia to prevail in any sense. But it may well be that the gal is thinking in these terms, but the issue can't be decided. The issue of the oath can't be decided in terms of that. It has to be decided in terms of whether or not there is a separation of church and state by the First Amendment, etc. And the only way that you could eliminate the position of the Islamic oath would be to argue that Islam was so socially reprehensible that it shouldn't be allowed to exist, that it would be similar to what? The Aztec religion, in which it's mandatory to sacrifice your neighbor on a funeral pyre, that sort of thing. And of course we cannot show this. So whatever the woman's motives are, the issue, it seems to me, remains the same.
This comes from David in Plymouth, Pennsylvania. He writes, "To swear or not to swear on the Bible falls along the same lines as the Ten Commandments being posted on public property. In the left-hand kingdom, it is unimportant whether a citizen recognizes the authority, that is God, behind the civil authority of the sword. What is important is that the citizen has a clear understanding of what the civil statute says about perjury, and it is enough for them to be terrified by the temporal consequences of breaking such a law. If you use the Bible as a means to force an unbeliever to recognize the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we are then stepping into the use of God's word that belongs to the right-hand kingdom exclusively." How would you react, Dr. Montgomery?
Oh, that was a good Lutheran. We can identify those Lutherans with no trouble at all. Yes. And his point is perfectly well taken, and it is necessary to distinguish the two kingdoms in dealing with this kind of issue. This simply means that in a fallen world, you're not going to be able to rely upon the gospel to solve in some magical way the issues in society or the issues that take place in the courts. I was hinting at this by pointing out again and again that to determine the truth in court, we don't rely upon an oath. What we rely upon is the force of the evidence admitted in the case and presented to the jury.
This is key, it seems to me, Dr. Montgomery, and you have restated this many times, finally sinking in here. What you're saying is the old medieval system wherein the oath itself somehow was self-evidence of truth-telling is an inferior system of determining fact. The evidential system that we have now that doesn't rely as much on the oath itself but simply makes the person giving testimony accountable is a superior way of determining fact in court.
Well, yes, and along the line of what the questioner just raised, the medieval approach was really a confusion of law and gospel, wasn't it? It was a mixing of the kingdoms.
This is from Joel in Dearborn, Michigan. Isn't the oath the reminder that one giving testimony, to the one giving testimony, there's a higher court, and if they lie in the human court, they will be held accountable for their lie before God? The oath was asking God to hold the oath taker responsible, and thus truth was not the safe lie, and no lie in that context is safe. he concludes the problem with the Quran is that it permits the lie, and Allah permits the lie. Thus, Islam could be seen as an illicit religion by natural law, since God, even in natural religion, cannot be a liar. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, I'm not sure that you could argue effectively that in Islamic doctrine there is no problem whatsoever with lying. This individual assumes that that's the case, there are some tremendous moral problems with Islam, and that's one of the reasons that I recommend those books by Robert Spencer. But I don't think that that's probably the line along which to move in order to resolve something like this. Because, as we've already said, all sinners are potential liars, and it's amazing how even Christians are able to rationalize lying under certain circumstances. The theory of the oath, of course, was that you were there in the presence, naked in the presence of Almighty God, and you'd better be very careful. And, you know, the architectural structure of courtrooms is very similar, at least historically, to cathedrals and temples. The High Court of Justice in London looks exactly like a neo-Gothic cathedral, and the whole idea was to remind you that this was something incredibly important, and what you said there had a bearing on eternity as well as in time, and all of that is good. There's no question about that. We ought to take this whole business as seriously as possible. It's the reason that the judges wear robes, for example, and in England, that as a barrister, I wear a wig, and so on and so on. All of this is part of the dignity of the law. But let's not deceive ourselves. Sinners manage to avoid all of that with no trouble whatsoever.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Faith Founded on Fact, and he joined us live from France this afternoon. Folks, there are only two slots available for Dr. Montgomery's International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. I was there this last summer. It's an experience. When you go, and if you have the privilege of being able to go to this, it is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Some people do it twice in a lifetime and become fellows. Well, it is an experience to remember, simply the value of the teaching itself, not to mention the fact that you're in one of the most beautiful segments of France, is worth all of it. Find out more by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click What's New, and you will find all the information you need about this summer's Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. Dr. Montgomery, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
You're most welcome.
Well, it's time to go to our listener comment line. We've got a lot of calls over the last week from listeners commenting on things they heard here throughout the week of Issues, etc. We'll be playing some of them for you. I should say, when you leave a comment, we're not going to be able to play all of them. They stack up rather quickly. So we play those that are kind of come to the point and have something interesting to say. We always want this comment line not only to be a place for Issues, etc., fans, so to speak, to speak their minds about what they've heard on the program, whether they're listening live or on the internet or by archived audio, but also for people who completely disagree with what we've said or how we went about it or what a guest had to say. The comment line is for you, too. Now, the number is 314-505-7825. That's the Issues, etc., listener comment line. It's 24 hours, and all you do is just call and leave a comment on something you heard. 314-505-7825. Let's hear some of these comments from Issues, etc., listeners, in no particular order.
Hi, it's Andy from Kirkwood. Didn't know if you'd seen this little blurb in the Post-Dispatch on Monday, the 12th of February. Jenna Lee Ryan of San Antonio last year began selling choice human embryos ready for prospective mothers to implant after having chosen from Ryan's catalog, describing the contributor's education, attractiveness, and medical history. quote, "We're just trying to help people have babies," end quote, she told the Washington Post in January, and at less cost than full in vitro procedures, because she has eliminated the risk of failed fertilization. But a bioethicist said, "It's like you're ordering a computer from Dell." Ryan said she does not take custom orders, however. Of her emphasis on well-educated, good-looking contributors of sperm and eggs, she said, quote, "Who wants an ugly, stupid kid?" End quote. Thought you might enjoy that. Bye.
I'll tell you what, Andy is one of the best listeners and callers we get. He gets the show completely. Andy, thank you very much for that comment on the Issues Etc. listener comment line. I was not aware of that, and I would say, although the woman is not yet taking custom orders, that yet is a big word. Sooner or later, if she's successful in providing this service, Andy, you and I both know that she will be taking custom orders, and you'll be able to just, it won't be a catalog, you'll just be able to fill out what you want in your embryo from her stock. Thank you very much for the comment, Andy. Here's another one from an Issues Etc. listener.
This lady that's talking on your show today, she believes that babies will go to heaven if something should happen to them and they're not baptized. And then she should be for abortion, because the child may grow up and turn against God and then end up in hell.
All right, that comes from an anonymous listener. And by the way, if you wish to leave your comment on the Issues Etc. listener comment line anonymously, we encourage that too. The number is 314-505-7825. And he's responding. Jeff, refresh my memory, because we talked about this before we went on the air. This listener is responding to a conversation we had recently. And what was the context of that conversation?
We re-aired an interview on baptism with Carl Fakenscher, and a caller was making the case that babies are innocent.
That's right. We were talking about baptism. Dr. Carl Fakenscher, we weren't so much making the case about infant baptism for a whole hour, but it, of course, comes up when you talk about the scriptural view of baptism. And, of course, whenever you do that, you're going to get listeners who think, well, babies couldn't be possible recipients. And the caller is very wise to point out that if babies are innocent and that the danger of sin only ensues after they're born or even after a certain age of accountability, all other things being equal, those who believe thus should be in favor of abortion, lest they risk these innocent, sinless babies go to hell, you know, actually be born and after the age of accountability, fall into sin. It does show how this whole notion of an age of accountability or original innocence rather than original sin is not only scriptural, but in many ways ethical nonsense, too. Thank you very much for that comment. We're getting some listeners' feedback through our Issues Etc. listener comment line. We're coming up on a break, and when we come back from this break, we'll get a few more. And as time permits, we might even do a little listener email that's been stacking up. We don't usually respond to email on the air, but it's a great time to respond, and I'm not really good about responding to my email off the air. Some audio open lines also on the other side of this break. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Christ Academy is a two-week residential program for high school-aged men on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Here's the director of Christ Academy, Brian Gurman.
The students at Christ Academy live in the dorms as a seminarian would. They study under the seminary professors, and they worship in Kramer Chapel. And it is literally taking the seminary experience and getting a good taste of it for those 2 weeks. And what they learn in the classroom then they experience in Kramer Chapel, as that is really the center of the experience, just as it is throughout the academic year here on campus as well.
At Christ Academy, high school-aged men explore the possibility of someday becoming a pastor. Christ Academy takes place June the 17th through the 30th on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. Look for the Christ Academy logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, 1-800-481-2155.
We thank Reliable Heating and Cooling for being a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO. Here's a few winter heating tips from Reliable. Don't let your furnace filters get dirty. Check the filters at least once a month, replace disposable filters, or clean the permanent ones whenever they do look dirty. Reliable Heating and Cooling performs routine maintenance, such as cleaning filters and humidifiers. 8463 Delport Drive, Reliable Heating and Cooling, 314-423-3535.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Speaking to leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention this week, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez unveiled plans to create a religious freedom task force that will review policies and cases of discrimination. Kim Troby reports the goal is to educate Americans on the problem of religious discrimination and teach them how to fix it.
Since the Bush administration has been in the White House, investigations of religious discrimination have jumped dramatically. People are complaining that they've been denied credit, employment, and other rights because of their religious beliefs. And the Department of Justice has made a concerted effort to take on the most egregious cases. Now Attorney General Gonzalez has announced the First Freedom Project, a nationwide series of training seminars aimed at the issue.
We are initiating a program of public education to make certain that people know their rights, and to build relationships with religious, civil rights, and community leaders to ensure that religious liberty concerns are brought to our attention.
At firstfreedom.gov, you can learn about your religious rights and how to file a complaint if they're violated. Jay Sekulow of the American Center for Law and Justice applauds the administration's awareness of the issue.
This administration has taken the issue of religious discrimination seriously. And because of that, you're now seeing investigations on religious discrimination issues, and they simply didn't exist before.
Members of the faith-based community, like Augie Boto, general counsel for the Southern Baptist Convention, are also encouraged.
We're seeing people stand up and say, you know, something's happening here that should not be happening, and we need help to explain this, and I'm glad that we have a place now to get that help.
Seminars will be held in Kansas City, Tampa, and Seattle, with more locations to follow. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
One fly in the ointment is that Gonzalez will only be in office until 2008. What happens to the religious task force after that time depends on who ends up in the White House. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
March 1st will soon be here, and that means the return of the Bible Study Repeat. Tom Baker's Law and Gospel program will continue to air from 1 till 3 daily, and the Bible Study Repeat will get underway at 6.05 p.m. So if you can't hear the Bible study during the morning, tune in during the evening. It all starts Thursday, March 1st, here on AM 850 KFUO, Inspirational Christian Radio for the World. Concordia Publishing House and Issues Etc. are pleased to offer our Book of the Month for February, titled A Seminary in Crisis. It's a history book that you won't be able to put down. A Seminary in Crisis tells the story about the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the early 1970s. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The book, A Seminary in Crisis.
I wanted to thank you for the interview with Ms. Gabriel about the Islamic terrorism and the fact that basically it helped explain a lot of the contradictions I've seen and how, well, if Muslims can lie to advance the cause, well, that makes a lot of sense with what we hear other people saying. So thank you very much for such a great program.
Another listener to Issues Etc. through our Issues Etc. listener comment line. We're hearing a few of them from this last week's comments from our listeners during this half hour, and we'll get some email here in a few minutes, too, from our listeners. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're not going to take some phone calls right now because technically it's impossible for Jeff to speak with you during this little operation, but as soon as we're done with this and we get into email, we'll take your phone calls and your email, too, issuesetc@kfuo.org. He was talking about Bridget Gabriel, who, we got a lot of email on this one. Bridget Gabriel wrote this book, Because They Hate, and she is a Christian Arab who was raised, if I'm not mistaken, in Lebanon. spent a lot of time under the boot heel of radical Islam there, watched her country go from a religiously tolerant democracy to a country run more or less by radical Islam, maybe not officially, but certainly unofficially, and has written about that experience, but also written about the fact that Islam is not what many, especially many in the halls of power in the U.S., suppose it to be. I thought it was a great interview, too, and she was a fantastic guest. Thank you very much for that comment. Here's another listener.
This is Robert calling somewhere in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. I'd just like to comment about the evangelical Anglican you interviewed. I wonder what he's doing in the hanging around in the Episcopal Church. Wouldn't John Shelby Spong, as a bishop, be enough to drive anybody who believes in Orthodox Christianity out of Episcopalism? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Robert. Well, I think he's referring to several interviews that we did with Father Todd Wetzel throughout the week, last week and this week, talking about the Anglican Communion. And you're right. If you should, you do wonder if John Shelby Spong, who, by the way, we have interviewed here on this program some years back, if John Shelby Spong, who denies virtually everything that is considered near and dear to the Christian faith, who wants to talk about a non-theistic Christianity, Christianity without a God, the Christ is merely an idea that can inspire. But certainly, he at one point, when people weren't checking his scholarship, he would deny the existence of Jesus Christ. Now he affirms the existence of Jesus Christ, but absolutely nothing other than the fact that there's somebody who someone called Christ lived. He's famous for saying that Christianity must change or die. If that's not enough to get you out of a church body, what would be? Well, we're learning now with the Episcopal Church what is enough. Oh, by the way, 5:30 today, last half hour of the program, Bishop Keith Ackerman is going to be our guest. He's Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Quincy, at least I believe he still is, and he's president of Forward in Faith North America, a reformed group in the Anglican Communion. I might ask him that question. We're going to be talking with him about the primates meeting that they had in Tanzania, the 38 primates of the Anglican Communion, including Catherine Jefford Shorey of the Episcopal Church USA. It's coming up 5:30 here on Issues, Etc. Here's another listener comment from our listener comment line.
Huntington, West Virginia. My wife Martha and I listened to your third hour from February 19th, your analysis of the Beth Moore teaching session. We appreciated some of the things that you said. However, we did think that it was a low blow for the comment about ordination and appointment to ministry without having investigated the education of the subject. We were concerned at the outset of the program that there seemed to be a lot of neglect in Todd Wilton's part of the third use of the law for teaching people how to honor and glorify God and what they do. Thankfully, that use of the law did appear later on in your analysis. We did enjoy the point on the Greek word aphiemi. I personally was waiting for her to say something about that being the verb used for departing airplanes in Greek airports, which would have been quite the hoot. We also very much appreciated your point of view that forgiveness is for the benefit of the person you forgive, not for your own benefit. If we as the body of Christ can get our hands on the idea that when we forgive, it's not for us, but it's for other people, then we'll do much better. Thank you for your interesting programs. We've enjoyed them a lot over the past year or so since we found your station.
Well, that's great to hear. A little criticism and a little commendation. That's what the Issues Etc. listener comment line is supposed to be all about. I will respond to a couple of those things, if as time permits here. I don't think it was a low blow about Beth Moore's, it's not her ordination, it's her lack of ordination. Of course, I did plead ignorance as to whether and what kind of qualifications Beth Moore does possess to be a Bible teacher abroad in the church. I think one of the listeners actually raised the question, it was Matt from Seward, Nebraska, if memory serves, raised the question of whether or not she had any formal qualifications to do what she's doing. And I said, I don't really know, although I doubt She does. I did check it out after the program, however, and she doesn't. There's no real ordination. She has some informal theological training from a football coach. I'm not joking. That's where her theological training came from, according to her own website, a football coach. That's what qualifies her to be a teacher abroad in the church. So when you think it's bad, sometimes it's worse than that. Now, as to the question of third use of the law, the reason I did not broach the subject of third use of the law when I was talking about Beth Moore's teaching, which is, let's just review, theologians have recognized three general uses for the law, three general functions of the law, a curb, a mirror, a guide, first, second, third use. The first one pertains to all men everywhere at all times. It is, we call, the civil use of the law. God, through his expressed will written on the hearts of all men, generally keeps order in human society. First use of the law applies to everybody. Second use of the law is that particular and the called the primary use of the law, not the first, but the most important use of the law, is mirror. That is, to accuse sinners of their sin and eventually condemn them, convict them of their sin. Now, you can't have third use until you get second use. Because third use is for Christians only. That is, law as guide, teacher, instructor. Not motivator. Not power source. But merely guide, teacher, instructor. And it's only for Christians. It's not for non-Christians. In fact, someone says, well, come on. We use Beth Moore in our church as an outreach to the unbelievers. And I would say, then you are woefully misusing. If she's all third use of the law, if she's all instruction through the law, unbelievers can't hear that yet. By the way, we don't control the uses. Beth Moore doesn't, I don't, you don't, the Holy Spirit does. But the reason I didn't talk about third use of the law is because since she wasn't preaching the gospel, she has no real warrant to preach the third use of the law. And in fact, the premise of her teaching that we critiqued there, Beth Moore's teaching during that hour, was that God places a condition on his forgiveness of you. That condition is that you forgive everyone else. That's not what Scripture teaches. If that is a use of the law, it's a misuse. Not first, second, or third use. It's a misuse of the law. That's why I didn't mention it. But I do understand the critique there. By the way, the law always accuses. Whether it's the first use, where God keeps order in society, it accuses people of their wrongdoing. Whether it's the second use, where God intends that his law convicts sinners of their sin, of course it accuses there. And even the third use accuses too. Guess what? It always accuses because it always finds something to accuse. It always shows us, in each and every case, where we have not lived up to its perfect demands. We're hearing some comments from our Issues Etc. listeners via our Issues Etc. comment line. The number for that comment line, 24 hours, anyone can call, 314-505-7825. It's the Issues Etc. comment line.
Hi. I was listening to a downloaded program on a show that was Open Lines, and one of the things you were talking about was why do pastors in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, allow for false teaching in their church? And I asked that very specific question to our pastor because at the particular church we go to, all of the Bible studies during the week, there's not one, I think there is one that is a Lutheran Bible study, but all the others are a pick of a pop evangelicalism. And so anyway, I asked the question, and his response was, and we have more than one pastor, so this was just one of the three, but his response is that that's what the people want, and they're going to get it outside of the church anyway. And he feels that that he's just going to give them basically what they want. And I, you know, expressed the need for some good, strong doctrinal Bible studies, and there's just very little desire for that at the church. So the church doesn't have a long history of adult Bible study. It's something more recent that they've done. For years they've gone without it. And for myself, I'm not going to waste my time with going to things that that I've just had from before I became Lutheran, and it was a waste of my time then. So because I come from a non-Lutheran background where I don't necessarily expect my church to know what the heck they're doing, and you just take a little here and a little there where you can get it, maybe I should find a church that is more confessional, but I guess I'm just too tired, and it is a good church in a lot of ways. So what I do is listen to things on Issues, etc., or KFUO website. I do my own Lutheran study that I have from Concordia, and my attitude is just, you know, to heck with them. If they don't want to do that, then I'm not going to waste my time, and they're probably tired of all my comments of what's wrong with the Bible study. So, I'm just tired of constantly giving them, and I find it's just a waste of my time. So, anyway, that's why I was calling. And keep up the good work, and I'm glad you addressed that question because it is an issue.
Now, that's interesting because we asked the question of our listeners, you know, how would pastors respond if you ask, why are you knowingly letting false teachers and teachings into your church? It's not unusual for Beth Moore, and it's not out of place for Beth Moore's teachings, or for that matter, any of the other popular fad teachings out there in the church, to be in, say, Baptist churches. That doesn't surprise me a bit, and it's not inconsistent because what she teaches is consistent with what Baptists teach. But for them to be in churches where they don't believe those things, or at least say they don't believe those things, is a bit puzzling. Very, very difficult words from our listener there to hear. I do have a few responses, though. The pastor saying, assuming she's hearing the pastor correctly, the pastor saying, look, this is what the people want. They're going to get it outside our church, so we might as well provide it to them inside our church. Do you remember the conversation we had earlier this week about parents saying about their teenage kids, hey, they're going to go out and drink anyway. Why don't we just have them get drunk here at home? Now, any parent with two brain cells to rub together can see what a disastrous parental policy that is. Why shouldn't a parent say, hey, they're going to use drugs, and they're going to get drunk, and they're going to have sex with each other before marriage outside the house? We might as well invite them inside the house to do it. I hardly even need to say this, but I'll say it anyway. Because getting drunk and having sex before marriage and using illicit drugs is dangerous and illegal in some of those cases. This highlights the problem. A pastor who's willing to say of his people, well, the reason we have false teachers in our church and we allow the false teaching into our church is because that's what people want. They want false teaching. Fill in the blanks, folks. It's a great little exercise. The people want false teaching. They're going to find false teaching outside the church, so we might as well give them false teaching inside the church. That's what the pastor is saying. A pastor could only say that if he actually believes that false teaching isn't harmful, if it's benign, neutral, innocuous. Of course, a pastor wouldn't have any scriptural support for that position. And it is sad to hear a listener say that they get their fed with solid teaching through programs like Issues, etc. Not that we're unhappy to do that, but Issues, etc. shouldn't be a substitute for a good church. It shouldn't have to be. We got some email here from our listeners. Jeff, let's do this together. Is that all right?
Yeah, I'll go first.
Because you read much better than I do.
I got Luke in Texas. This is dealing on this subject. Well, somewhere on the subject, we'll go to email.
Okay,
subject.
Luke in Texas. What
and
do you
what's
have to
the
say?
Question? What was the questions again for people?
Huh? What?
Why do pastors?
Oh, why would a pastor knowingly allow a false teaching or false teachers into their church, contrary to what their church says that they believe?
And also, why do lay people?
Yeah, why would lay people clamor for this?
Promote?
Yeah.
Says teaching. Well, here's Luke from Texas. He's got some thoughts on it. May not know better, even though they should. He's talking about pastors and church leaders. One example of this is two pastors I know who preach the third use of the law as though it's the gospel. What I mean by that is they preach the law as sanctification and not sanctification as gospel. They should know better, but they really think they're preaching sanctification as gospel, even though they're not.
Okay, so Luke is essentially saying one explanation might be that even though I say pastors who should know better, these are, in fact, pastors who don't. Okay?
Another one from Luke from Texas. Church growth excites. Church growth excites people.
You don't
to,
read better than I do, do you?
I'll do that.
It ain't
do,
so
I'll,
easy, is it there? Yeah.
Church growth excites people to. You should be waving frantically like, come on, Wilkin. Church growth excites people to, at times, focus on numbers instead of truth. Materials that are contrary to that truth tend to be popular and push growth. Why not if it means getting people in? After all, if we're growing, then God must be blessing us. It's an itching ears thing. In John 6, when Jesus was talking about eating and drinking his flesh and blood, many people stopped following him because the truth is ultimately a stumbling block and folly to the world. So why preach the truth when some people tend to turn away from it? The latter is easier to preach and people enjoy it more.
I like what Luke has to say there. He's been thinking this one through.
Dr. Bob Godfrey, the president of Westminster Seminary in California, once called that John 6 passage on this show, Jesus' church shrink program.
Will you two also go away? And most of them did.
And you've brought this up before, too. Jesus didn't say, hey, come back here. Let me restate what I said. I didn't mean to be so harsh.
You misunderstood me. Please come back. I will soften my teaching if it means keeping you in the pews. No.
And one more for Luke?
Mm-hmm.
For those who use the purpose-driven life, for example, they think they can remove the junk and just teach the good, and that justifies their decision in using such a book.
Yeah, I've heard that before, that they say they remove the junk, but then they have the video links to Rick Warren, sometimes in the place of the sermon, where Rick Warren gets to teach in their church, and they're not editing the video. Sometimes it's a live satellite link. This very Saturday, if I'm not mistaken, Beth Moore is going to be having a live satellite link. How do you edit a live satellite link? What if she does start talking about generational curses, as she is wont to do at times? Will the pastor stand in front of the big screen waving his arms saying, don't listen to this part, don't listen to this part, this part is wrong? I doubt it. I really doubt it. Paul in Milwaukee writes this. He has answers to the same questions. Why would a parent church body, he actually adds some answers we didn't even ask for. Why would a parent church body tolerate and practice false doctrine? Here are his theories from Paul in Milwaukee. Refusal to exercise oversight of individual congregations. That's true. Graduating or ordaining weak, impressionable, or heretical pastors or other church worker candidates. Yeah. Observation of deviancy and the conclusion that more will be tolerated at a tolerable or at no cost. Now, let me translate what Paul said there in that third point. What he's saying is when people see that false teaching is in the church, they say, well, it's not hurting us that bad. It's worth the cost. It's not too dangerous. It's another way of pastors or church congregations, church bodies, lay people saying false doctrine doesn't hurt people. When it does. As to the pastoral question, Paul says it could be lazy pastors. It could be careerist pastors and other church workers. In other words, they're just biding their time until they hit 62, or in my case, 67. Or it could be making basic decisions to introduce the spirit of the age into the ageless gospel in the congregation in music, liturgy, dumbed-down teaching. And then as to the laity question, Paul offers these theories. Pushing the ethics of business and pop culture into the congregation. Allowing reports from the pulpit, technology and communication over Christology, sales goals, corruption of the Bible language for jargon. One possible theory, he says, is C.S. Lewis addressed it long ago, men without chests. Lewis meant men who aren't men anymore. They don't value the truth. Another possible explanation for laity clamoring for false teaching, female heads of house. I don't think he means to indict females. I think he there intends to indict the lack of men. And the fourth theory about why, from Paul in Milwaukee, about why the lay people might be clamoring for false teaching in their congregations, knowingly clamoring for it. And I think this says everything. It's two words. And I think it explains a lot of stuff, like the popularity of just about every Christian book that's found its way through the fad mill of the local congregation. Herd mentality. Or I could reduce it to one word, bandwagon. You got one more? Let's hear it, Jeff.
This is Kia from Birmingham. Because we did this discussion on Kay Arthur. What's the name? I wasn't here. Beth Moore.
Beth Moore.
So one of the reasons I brought up why pastors don't say no is because it's a woman's thing. You know, they're afraid to tell women no in their congregation. So Kia writes this from Birmingham. My husband and I were military and have traveled all over. While attending chapel and other study groups, I've been dismayed to find that most women care very little about theology and are very uncritical about heresies or things that are potentially problematic. So, while I tried to show that that matters concerning the Trinity were essential to our faith and other subjects of the like, I was only labeled as being, quote, the smart, end quote, one, not as defending the faith handed down by our forefathers.
Yeah, now it's somehow intellectually rarefied air to want to understand theology. Theology takes on this, oh, that's a specialization. I'm no theologian. Nonsense. We're all theologians. Theology is simply what you believe and say about God. If you're a Christian, you're a theologian. You might be a lousy one, but you can't deny that you are one, one way or the other. All right, that's our listener comment line and some of the email from our listeners as well when we come back from this break. What are we going to do? Audio open lines. We'll put the mouthpiece back into Jeff's phone so he can take your phone calls and your email, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. By the way, that listener comment line is open 24 hours. Good, bad, ugly, we want to hear it all from you, our listeners. 314-505-7825, 314-505-7825. You can call anonymously. You can call when you've listened to something in archived audio, you can call when you listen to something live via the internet. You can call when you're listening right now. It's a great place for you to register your comments about what you're hearing here on Issues, etc., and for us to receive them. And by the way, if you don't want us to use it on the air, if you really, really don't want us to use it on the air, you can say so, but it's part of the reason we have the comment line. 314-505-7825, 314-505-7825. It's the Issues Etc. listener comment line. We'll be right back with audio open lines.